My name is Mike Elgin, and this is my Food and Technology Podcast number 3. My guest this week is David Asher. Quick warning, this program is not suitable for vegans. Here comes the FatCast. The FatCast is a weekly conversation with visionaries who are making the world a better place. You can find the FatCast online at elgin.com, and you can subscribe on iTunes or from the podcast app of your choice. Thanks for listening. I first discovered David Asher when my wife gave me his book, which is called The Art of Natural Cheesemaking, and I recommend the book to everybody listening to this podcast. In the book, David introduced me to a much better way to make cheese by using the bacteria, fungi, and yeast naturally present in raw milk to ferment and transform that milk into delicious cheese. Of course, this is how cheese was made for centuries. It's only recently that pasteurized and homogenized milk forced cheesemakers to need all kinds of new ingredients and additives to make the process work at all. Still, David's perspective is rare, and some of his methods are new even to experienced cheesemakers. In fact, in Canada, where David lives, it would be illegal to sell many of his cheeses commercially. David teaches his approach to cheesemaking. He calls it the Black Sheep School of Cheesemaking. And this is how I caught up with him. I recently took an all-day class from David at a place called Shed in Healdsburg, California. Shed happens to be one of my favorite restaurants, and they also sell super high-quality cooking and gardening stuff. Our conversation took place at Shed near the kitchen, so there's a lot of background noise in the recording, but hang in there. David's ideas will transform how you look at the whole range of dairy products we eat every single day. Here's my interview with David Asher. David Asher, thanks for joining the FatCast.
Happy to be here.
So glad you're here. I enjoyed your class today. We are at Shed in Healdsburg, and you taught one of your amazing classes in cheese making. It was so cool. But let's start from the beginning. How did you get started in cheese making?
I think that nobody ever really thinks they're going to become a cheesemaker. It's not like a culture we're born into here in North America like it is in Europe. I never thought this was going to be my medium. I was living a whole other life, not really excited about the work I was doing as an engineer,
wanting something a little bit more.
I studied environmental engineering.
Okay.
Sewage treatment engineering, actually, and the processes of fermentation that are involved in sewage treatment are actually remarkably similar to what's involved in cheese making.
That's disturbing.
Surprisingly, that's actually what got me into kefir culture.
It's all part of the circle of life.
Yeah, that's it. So the principles I learned in sewage treatment, I'm actually applying, in my cheese making.
That's amazing. That is absolutely amazing. Now, you're a revolutionary. I consider you one of the three people who's completely changing how food works. I'd say you. It's Sandor Katz and Chad Robertson.
Chad.
Yeah. Yes. All three of you are looking to the past, applying new ideas to traditional food making that involves fermentation.
Yeah.
And are part of this, or you know, the forefront of this movement to make our food great again. And we've kind of lost it now. To a non-cheesemaker, the difference between conventional cheesemaking, quote unquote conventional, as it's generally made, the cheese you buy in the store, on the one hand, and the way that you teach people to make cheese on the other, may seem minor. It's mostly raw food and natural ingredients in your case, and it's pasteurized milk, homogenized milk, and a whole bunch of other
starters, things.
Yeah. On the other, a more industrial process. Why is the conventional way of cheese making so different from the way that you teach people to make cheese?
So I guess a simple way of looking at it is that conventional cheese making involves monoculture, whereas the method of cheese making that I involved is more of a diversity approach to cheese making. And cheesemakers who work with the industrial model, whether they be artisanal, home cheesemakers, or industrial cheesemakers, and by and large in North America, everybody makes cheese this industrial chemical way. They add in individual strains of packaged, freeze-dried culture, specifically chosen for making certain varieties of cheese, and then make the cheese to that specification. So they make that certain style of cheese with that certain particular culture. To get it all started, though, they'll pasteurize their milk to create a blank slate to prevent any microbial competition and introduce those individual species of starter that they hope will encourage that cheese to develop into that particular flavor and color and texture and flavor and such. Whereas in my approach in cheese making, I encourage folks to work with the indigenous microorganisms of raw milk, and not just, you know, two or three strains of microorganisms that cheesemakers add in those packets freeze-dried cultures, but a diversity, like hundreds of different species that are present in raw milk, bacteria, fungi, and yeast that all live naturally in it. And I show people how to use raw milk and kefir, which is a similar, you know, microecology, a similar similar diversity of microbes. I show people how to use kefir and raw milk as a starter culture and how to handle that diverse starter culture in a different way. And the cheeses that result are surprisingly different from those that are made using more industrial monoculture methods. I don't have to worry about adding in a different starter culture for making different styles of cheese. The milk's got what it needs to become any different style of cheese. And just working with the cheese the right way encourages the right cultures to thrive. It encourages that cheese to develop into have any particular flavor. And the style of cheese that I promote is more in line with traditional methods that evolved long before cheesemakers had access to these packages of freeze-dried culture that allow them to make kind of any style they want to, but take away from the, you know, the heart and soul of cheesemaking.
So to rework part of what you're saying, the pasteurization process actually kills microorganisms that are then later reintroduced,
exactly,
minus all the other things that those particular favorable microorganisms might have had to compete with. And this is really, to me, that's the quintessential industrial process. You have a specific end in mind.
Yeah.
You isolate the variables. It's reductionist. Mm-hmm. And then you introduce only the known solid versions that you know are absolutely going to give you the end product.
Yeah.
But in the old days, and in your case, there's more of an art to it, where you, instead of slaughtering everything and reintroducing, you're favoring the microorganisms that you want through temperature, through handling,
yep,
through a variety of things. And you have the advantage of knowing what microbiology is, whereas in traditional, in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance, they didn't really know.
Understanding. Yeah.
There was a magic spoon that somehow produced the results they wanted, and what you know now is that spoon was...
carries with it something special from
exactly
one batch to the next.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's an encapsulation of your philosophy of cheesemaking. What is the black sheep school of cheesemaking?
So the black sheep school of cheesemaking shares a different way of making cheese. It's my educational endeavor. It's what I presented here to this class here at the Healdsburg Shed today. It's a traveling cheese school. It doesn't have a home base. I take my education on the road, bringing cheese outreach through workshops like these to food and community-minded organizations all across North America. My methods are different than those that are practiced by just about every cheesemaker in North America, and so I've owned the term, you know, black sheep, because what I'm doing is different, and I'm not getting, you know, very positive reviews from a lot of cheesemakers out there. Folks who are doing things that, you know, the standard industrial way, don't like to be, you know, aren't really accepting of the criticism that I'm bringing their way. I feel, you know, they're doing things really well. They're working with good raw milk. A lot of cheesemakers are out there working with raw milk, working with natural cheese caves, you know, doing everything by hand. Mm-hmm. But the cultures that they use, don't fit in line with a style, a philosophy, and ethos of their cheesemaking. And they're really shortchanging themselves by buying these packaged starter cultures, which they believe make cheesemaking easier. Because traditional starter cultures, you know, in whey, in kefir, in raw milk, actually help their cheeses develop better flavors, encourage them to develop more interesting ecologies, and make the cheese making process a whole lot easier. But they're stuck in their ways, and they don't want to try something new.
And the end process, the end result is almost certainly safer, as well as healthier.
Likely, yeah, very likely. So.
I mean, if you take a quart of pasteurized milk and a quart of raw milk, and you leave them both out for 3 days. Do not drink the pasteurized milk, ladies and gentlemen, because you might die.
But leaving that raw milk to sit out at room temperature for 3 hours is the first step in developing a raw milk starter culture that you can use to begin the process of making just about any style of cheese. And I encourage folks to do that in my book with raw milk, but it's something you just can't do with pasteurized.
Right.
It's not safe.
Now, you live in Canada. We are in the United States. I know you've also taught classes in Australia and all around the world, but those three countries, Canada, Australia, and the United States, to the best of my knowledge, are super freaked out from a legal point of view about raw milk.
Yeah.
Especially, I understand Australia is really crazy in terms of illegalizing raw milk.
Tough.
Canada
is
pretty bad too.
Canada
right?
is real bad. Australia
is worse in some respects. In Canada, you cannot sell raw milk under any circumstances. A farmer cannot sell raw milk to the public. You can buy raw milk if you're a cheesemaker, you got a certified, you know, raw milk handling license, but that's out of reach of most average folks. We are allowed to make raw milk cheeses, though, just like in the United States. We can age raw milk cheeses a minimum of 60 days and then eat them. In Quebec, one of the provinces in eastern Canada, there's actually special legislation that allows cheesemakers there to produce raw milk cheeses and sell them less than 60 days. That's actually unique in North America.
Well, it's the French influence, isn't it?
The French influence. They have a real culture of cheesemaking. They understand that, you know, certain cheeses, fresh cheeses, just aren't the same if they're made with pasteurized milk. And they fought a long battle with health authorities in order to allow the sale of raw milk cheeses aged less than that certain time, because they needed this cheeses as part of their culture and refused to accept the pasteurization regulations. In Australia, things are worse on the cheese side, actually better on the milk. In Australia, you can't sell raw milk for drinking, but there are a number of dairies there that sell raw milk for bathing. And, you know, not that many people are actually taking baths in it. It's it's just a, you know, a wording.
It sounds like a loophole. Because I know in the U.S. there are lots of loopholes as well. There are shares where we did that for a while, where you theoretically own part of a goat for a certain amount or whatever, and you get milk. But really, you're buying milk.
Yeah.
It's just, it was illegal in that particular place. So there's a lot of people trying to get around it.
We're trying to do that in Canada now. The herd share exists up there. It's the only semi-legal way to get raw milk. We have a number of dairy farmers that have started up cow share programs in our area, who sell essentially a teat of their animal, and everybody who buys a teat is thus entitled to milk that teat produces, and therefore they're able to gain access to raw milk without actually having their own farm. But that's kind of semi-legal. The jury's out as to what the future of that's going to be. The only real legal way to get raw milk in Canada is to go across the border to the United States, fill up your jugs at a raw milk dairy and bring them back across the border into Canada.
It's legal to bring it into Canada.
Free trade.
That's wild.
Interestingly, free trade agreements allow us to bring anything across the border that we like, including a substance that's banned on one side.
That's amazing, because in the United States, it's illegal to bring in milk from Pennsylvania into New York, but you can bring it from Pennsylvania to Canada. And that's
fascinating,
legal.
Right?
That is crazy. Now, what is food sovereignty? You talk about food sovereignty on your website, which, by the way, is theblacksheepschool.com.
That's right.
And if you want to see what some of these cheeses look like, because I know everybody listening to this is curious, go to theblacksheepschool.com/natural-cheeses, and you'll see a big page of photos that are mind-blowing. But what is food sovereignty?
So food sovereignty is the idea that people have, that people, you know, farmers, consumers, eaters, that everyday people have control over where their food comes from and how it's produced. And here in North America, food sovereignty is a new idea, but it's also an old idea. It's how all our food used to be made. It used to be grown in community, processed, and preserved in community. All the food that nourished us was grown within our regions, grown by farmers. It was grown by people that were involved in the process, and not controlled by organizations that aren't necessarily very, you know, interested in our best interests. And the way we're fed these days in North America is quite a bit different. You know, there are undercurrents in various areas that are trying to rebuild traditional food sheds where the community feeds itself. But by and large in North America, the food system is controlled by corporate interests that control the movement and growing of food. And their interests are not necessarily in our best interests, or those of the environment. And food sovereignty is the idea that we're trying to take back our the production of our food from corporate farms and corporate farmers that are doing things to our food that we may not be in agreement with, taking back control of that process.
Well, I think it's important for people like you to fight for food sovereignty, because, of course, corporations are fighting on the other side to reduce our food sovereignty.
That's right.
And in fact, I believe it was last week when in the United States, Congress passed a bill that the meat industry has been wanting for a long time, which is a bill that basically says that they no longer have to tell you where the meat comes from.
Oh.
So we could be getting meat from China. It could be from anywhere. And they can have a nice picture on the package that shows a Wyoming ranch.
Oof.
But it could be from Shenzhen, China, or something like that, from some underground factory farm or something like that. They don't have to tell us now.
Wow.
So that's a big blow to our food sovereignty.
Huh. That's a step back.
Isn't it horrible?
Yeah.
But they've been wanting it for a long time, the industry, because it just you know, it's a cost thing.
Mm-hmm. And then, so, you know, the dairy industry is looking for similar things here in North America. They're looking to conceal the truth about how dairy is produced, processed. You know, the exact same thing that you talked about, the beautiful picture of the pasture on the yep. package is exactly what you see of the beautiful pasture on a milk bottle, which, yes. you know, very few animals in North America actually have access to. You know, the vast majority of animals that produce milk in North America are kept in confinement dairies yeah. and treated under conditions that we would consider inhumane. And if we knew the whole story of how much of our milk and much of our cheese that comes from that milk is produced, we wouldn't want to eat this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Turn our stomachs.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I was thinking about this on two points you made in the class today. You demonstrated the making of butter, cultured butter. So you cultured the milk first using, in the United States, we say kefir. In Canada, you say kefir.
Kefir. Yeah.
So, but we've all heard of it. We've seen the plastic bottles in the store.
Yeah.
And they sell it as a health drink because, in fact, kefir or kefir is a very healthy beverage. But what's in that bottle is not, by your definition, and not by mine, it's not. So it's a compromised thing, but yeah. they're using this theoretical vestigial memory we have of the health benefits of kefir to sell this thing that isn't kefir. And likewise with buttermilk. Buttermilk, you made the point that up until 150 years ago, whenever, but all butter was cultured because just allowing the cream to rise to the top gave the milk time at room temperature to culture. Mm-hmm. And then what's left over when you extract the butter is buttermilk, which is a cultured product.
Naturally.
Now the butter is no longer cultured, but the buttermilk is artificially cultured.
Yeah.
They're selling, they're dealing with this sort of ancestral memory that buttermilk is this cultured healthy beverage,
yeah.
and they're giving us something else.
Yeah, it's totally preposterous.
Yeah.
Our food system's totally broken.
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely.
And especially in dairy, we have less control over the way in which our dairy is produced than perhaps any other sector of our study. We know less about it. Few people know the process of making cheese. Traditionally, like this, was, cheese making was a part of every household, and it could be again. We could, you know, take back our cheese.
Cheese making, butter making, all the rest of it.
It all fits in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, now you are really into DIY,
mm-hmm.
And you have a lot of respect for your readers of your book, and because you say, you know, here's how you can do it in a way that's natural, but pretty easy. And if you really want to go hardcore, here's how you do that version.
Yeah.
And I followed two of your instructions, one of which is cultivating blue cheese mold to make blue cheese.
That's right. You
and
can
so
do it.
What I did was I got some blue cheese from France. It was actually from Roquefort, France, which
yep,
is the
stuff.
The caves of which is where blue cheese mold probably originates. And I baked some naturally leavened bread on ancient grains. I just cut a slice. I smeared a tiny bit of blue cheese on it, and I followed your instructions in the container, a closed container, to cultivate blue, took over the
That's
whole thing,
right. yeah.
turning it over. Then I dried it, now put it in a jar, and now whenever I want to make blue cheese, I have this jar that I can use. So that was awesome.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed doing that. And then you also give instructions for extracting rennet from a sheep or any sort of ruminant. So we actually bought got a sheep.
Yeah.
We paid a sheep.
Okay.
For working on a farm, and
yeah.
we had it slaughtered. We kept all the meat, of course, and
yeah.
we got the fourth stomach, and I processed it per your directions, and it's currently curing
in salt.
Yeah. And it's looking good. You know, it's looking great. So when that's done after 6 months, according to your instructions, I'll be able to take a piece of that.
That's right.
Put it in my milk, and then that's rennet. I don't have to buy rennet at the store. It'll be and so on. I'm not sure it'll work because I don't have a.
The animal may not have been young enough.
Yeah.
It may not have had the rennet enzyme present in its stomach that helps that coagulation happen. But it might
but
still.
But I'll learn.
Yep, you'll learn.
And I'll learn how to do it. Yeah, those are examples of the DIY. And your instructions are super easy to do. People can,
Thank you.
You can really make all kinds of. I've never thought of you making Camembert and brie and cheddar and different kinds of. I've made feta before. Through a different process, but now I'm making it through your process, and it tastes better.
Yeah.
And so it's really awesome that your book enables people to just really, I mean, you want to talk about from scratch? Really from scratch. I'm really starting with a cow in our case.
Yeah.
That's scratch.
That's right.
Yeah.
The cow and the young lamb, right?
Yeah.
yeah.
And you enjoy it more when you've made it. And
totally. When you take control, when you take ownership over that process,
yeah.
I mean, everything ends up better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, do you have a few more minutes?
I
want to get into something that was really interesting from your class. And you started talking about rennet.
Yeah.
And you didn't have a whole lot of time to really go into super detail, but you pointed out that when you go to cheese-making supply websites and you buy rennet, most of the rennet you get, especially the vegetarian rennet, is kind of a weird thing, and it's kind of a super high-tech thing.
Yeah.
You talk about the super high-tech rennet you're likely to buy if you buy vegetarian rennet at one of the cheese-making sites.
So, you know, if you're buying a rennet replacement in your cheese-making, if you're not buying the traditional calf rennet, you're buying what are known as, you know, vegetarian rennet sometimes, although they're not really all that vegetarian, because milk and, you know, cannot be vegetarian. They come from ingredients that are highly processed. They're not as natural as they're purported to be. And if people knew like the full story of where these replacement enzymes come from, they probably wouldn't want to purchase them. For instance, one of the main brands of enzymes that's produced for cheese making today is produced by the agribusiness and chemical giant DuPont. Dow DuPont, like an even bigger chemical giant, cheesemakers that want to do things sustainably, do things on a small scale or artisanal scale, that are using this product are totally going against their ethos by choosing this brand of rennet from the brand name Danisco. It's not right for them to be using it. They do it anyway because they don't know a better way. They don't know that there necessarily was anything.
But how do they do? How do they achieve the? How do they simulate?
How do they produce that?
Yeah.
So this particular type of rennet is raised by a species of microbe called Mucor mehii. It's a type of fungal culture that's raised in bioreactors in a laboratory setting in Colombia. Interestingly, this fungal culture naturally produces an enzyme that's very similar to calf's rennet under the right conditions, but changes the cheese a little bit. The cheese doesn't end up developing exactly the same qualities as it does if it's calf rennet. The enzyme works; it coagulates the curd, but in the end, the cheese tastes a little ends up having a little bit of rubbery texture and ends up with a slightly bitter flavor. So it's not exactly the same. There's an even more, technically involved rennet that's out there. A lot of cheesemakers are using this in their cheese in North America here, but consumers don't know about it. In fact, the vast majority of cheese made in North America is made with it. And this other questionable rennet that a lot of cheesemakers are using is a genetically modified rennet. And it's produced with the aid of a microorganism that has a gene inserted into it from a cow that allows this microbe to produce the rennet enzyme without having to slaughter a young calf in order to produce it.
And is that sold as vegetarian?
And so this is often sold as vegetarian rennet because no calves were slaughtered in its making. Sold as a rennet substitute, but it's not labeled for its true self, which is a genetically modified rennet. And here in North America, lots of cheese uses it. We don't have to label it, but in Europe, it has to be labeled on the packaging if the GMO products are used, and therefore, for the most part, cheeses made in Europe are not made with this genetically modified rennet. The exception is, of course, cheeses that are exported to North America, where such labeling doesn't have to be included on the package, and a lot of cheese exported from Europe is made with this genetically modified rennet, too.
So they make the good stuff for the domestic consumption. They send the compromised version to the U.S. because we don't care or no.
That's right. That's exactly what happens.
Yeah. Okay. now, you're always experimenting, you're always learning. And, for example, you pointed out in your class today that you discovered that you can actually create your own yogurt culture. I think everybody believes that you have to get yogurt culture in order to make yogurt. You have to get yogurt culture from another batch of yogurt. That's the only place you can possibly get it. You figured out how to roll your own yogurt culture. That's an example.
It's pretty empowering.
You do a lot of stuff with kefir. You use kefir for all kinds of things that I never heard kefir being used for. So it's like you're really into kefir. But let me ask you this: what have you learned or discovered since you sent your book off to the publisher that you would have included in the book had you discovered it earlier?
Oh, so it's a continual voyage of discovery. I spent a lot of time with a Russian cheesemaker recently who introduced me to some of the specific fermented dairy products of her region that I would have loved to include in my book, and that I will include little short excerpts about in my next one. For instance, she makes this one sheep cheesemaker in Ontario that I visited with last month. She makes this beautiful Russian yogurt that she called Rajinka. And the Rajinka is a long-cooked yogurt. So instead of just cooking the milk for half an hour as we did in class today to make our yogurt, what she does is she cooks her milk for over 8 hours And as the milk is cooked for over 8 hours, the milk caramelizes as a result of the heat.
It's almost like condensed milk.
Yep. It thickens up considerably, and the chemical structure of the yogurt changes. And then when she takes that cooked milk and cools it down, she then adds her culture to it. And that caramelized milk turns into a beautiful caramelized, colored and flavored yogurt. It's unlike anything else I've ever tasted. I'll definitely be including a recipe of that in the second version. And there's a couple of other interesting Eastern European style cheeses that I didn't realize were so easy that she introduced me to that I'll happily include in the book too. And you know, there's cheese making traditions from all around the world that I have yet to explore, and I'm sure in future editions there will be cheeses from other places as well.
Yeah, awesome. Now, when is that book you and me expect to...
Oh, the next edition?
Yeah.
Well, it all depends. It's going to be the same book, but a next edition, and hopefully within 12 months another edition will be printed, and I'll be able to make those changes.
Hmm. So this podcast is about food and technology. Oftentimes I talk to a technology visionary and ask them about some of their food stuff.
Yeah.
You're a food visionary. So let me ask you about your technology stuff. Like, what do you do that's high tech? What part of your process is, or maybe you can...
In terms of my cheese making or my life?
Either one. Okay. Let's just start with, what sort of computer do you have? What kind of phone do you have? That sort of thing.
So, I was computerless for a really long time.
Really?
I decided I didn't want to have it in my life because I've had issues with computer addiction in the past. Mm-hmm. I spent way too much time online, playing games and just wasting time. And I felt really bad about having a computer in my vicinity. I was happy to use others and to use libraries. And for many years, I did that. But when I got my book contract, I realized I should probably have my own tool to use, my own computer to use to make this book possible. The way modern publishing is, I really had no choice. I got a MacBook, and it it's amazing, it's wonderful, and it's really helped me do a lot of what I do. Communication for me is key. I use my computer regularly to communicate with folks all around the world that I'm coordinating workshops with. Mm-hmm. Coordinating this workshop series in California that I'm currently on would have been impossible with it. Being in touch with folks in Australia about my upcoming tour would never have happened. Fans are able to reach out to me much quicker and from much broader areas with the use of it, and so I'm very happy that I've got it a part of my life now, because things would not be the same without it.
And your cheese making is very low tech. You were doing temperature without a thermometer.
Yeah.
So that's pretty low tech. Finger is pretty low
tech. That's right.
Sort of a touch-based system, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. And what would you like to tell the world out there? And this audience is not, some are super foodies, but many are not.
Yeah.
It's the general public of curious, intelligent people in my audience here. What would you like to tell them about the world of cheese and making their own cheese and of raw milk cheese or whatever? What's your message to?
I'd like to tell people that it's just entirely possible, that the methods of cheese making are totally approachable and totally doable in your own home kitchen. You've got the culture of cheese in your hands. You can do it. A lot of people think that cheese making is something that's beyond their understanding, their comprehension. You need a microbiological degree in order to understand the dynamics of the cheese making process. You need a sterilized factory setting in order to produce it. That's the impression I had when I started out. I didn't know that cheese could really be made at home, but it totally can, using household tools and equipment. Our ancestors made wonderful cheeses in their own homes, with microbes and raw milk, without using any specialized tools or technology. You don't need a microbiology degree to make cheese. And you can understand the processes entirely well from an ecological perspective, from a new way of looking at things, compared to the microbiological way we look at things today. The traditional technologies of fermentation are totally adaptable to cheese making. Anybody who can ferment sauerkraut or make kombucha at home can use very similar processes to make cheese, very delicious cheese, in their own home too.
Now, you reminded me of something that was in your class that was kind of a mind blower, which is that this whole kefir thing. You're doing all these really interesting things with kefir. I always knew kefir as this beverage, and it has these kefir grains in it that carry the symbiotic cultures to the next batch and so on. But you're taking it and you're putting the grains in grape juice and you're putting it in the... And what I learned from you is that if you just take any sort of juice, anything with sugar in it, right, and throw the kefir grains in, the 24 hours that you have soda.
Yep.
So you have an effervescent, if you seal the container, it will actually be a fizzy drink.
Yep. You leave it delicious. A little bit longer, it'll turn into alcohol.
And then, and interestingly yeah. enough, we went down for lunch here at Shed, and they served, they have on the menu, a delicious kefir beverage that, I mean, it was just...
it all fit right in.
Yeah, yeah. It was really delicious. Mm-hmm. What, besides making your own soda beverages, what's the most surprising thing you think people don't know about what you can do with kefir?
One of the things I shocked people with today in class is that kefir can be used to make a really beautiful cultured butter. And the way that's done is really easy. You take your kefir grains, you put them into cream, let them ferment the cream for 24 hours at room temperature, and that cream thickens up into a thickened creme fraiche, a cultured cream. You can eat that cultured cream as is. It's delicious. Alternative to whipped cream, it takes a lot less work to make, no whipping involved. The bacteria do all the whipping for you, thicken up the cream just beautifully. But you can then take that cream and thickened cultured cream and churn it. And the kefir remain in the cream as it's being churned. It actually aid with the churning, so the tortured surface actually breaks apart the butterfat particles quite a bit more and encourages the butter to come together quicker. And in the end, you get this delicious cultured butter that developed with the aid of kefir culture. And the butter kind of coalesces out of the buttermilk and it ends up having the kefir grains kind of mixed within it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people in the class were thinking, well, how the hell do you get those kefir grains out of there? They're all mixed up in the greasy butter. And then I show them that you just take that butter, take that butter, put it into a pot of cold water to wash it of its remaining buttermilk. And as you wash the butter, the kefir grains end up just like falling out of the butter because the butter butter attracts fat and rejects anything that's not mm-hmm. fat. And so the kefir grains, which aren't fat, they're like this weird protein sugar matrix, they end up falling out of the butter and end up sinking to the bottom of the water. And the butter that results after washing is pure and clean, free of its kefir culture, but full of flavor from its kefir fermentation. And the kefir grains, you just dip your hand to the bottom of the water, take them out, and then put them in some more cream and continue on with that fermentation process. And like the beauty of that process makes it seem as though kefir was made for butter making, for cheese making. It's so well behaved. It's hard to believe it wasn't like designed for this.
And when you make butter, a liquid part separates from a more solid part. The more solid part is butter. The more liquid part is buttermilk. Yes. We drank some. It was amazing.
Unreal.
Amazing buttermilk. And the butter, by the way, was the best tasting butter I've had in North America.
Likely.
I mean,
and it's nothing like it here.
You can find butter that's kind of like that in France, maybe, and in places where you know. But that was really amazing. And most amazing thing of all, if you've tried kefir, you may like it, may not like it. It has a very particular taste.
Yeah.
The butter tasted nothing like kefir at all.
Totally different. You know, the kefir has a certain flavor because it's made a certain way. It's not because of the microorganisms in the kefir that the kefir tastes the way it does. It's because of the way milk ferments naturally when it sits at room temperature. And if you handle that milk differently, using the same kefir microorganisms, you can transform it into a vast array of different things with very different flavors, because it's not necessarily just the milk or the culture that makes the cheese taste the way it does, but the way that milk is handled along its cheese-making journey that has the greatest effect on the flavors that develop.
Unbelievable.
So kefir is capable of some amazing things. Milk is capable of unreal transformations too. And both together, they really get along well.
David Asher, I want to thank you for coming on the FatCast.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thanks for listening to the FatCast. I'd love to get your feedback and ideas. Send email to mike@elgin.com. If you like this podcast, make sure you subscribe and share it with a friend. Until next time, this is Mike Elgin. See you next week.